less questions. Okay, thank you so much. Here we go. Having abandoned effort-based meditation, I have found that I can have a certain level of stillness effortlessly. Thank you. You're welcome. I find that mild pity, that's joy, arises and falls like a lava lamp. Sometimes the joy rises in a burst but seems to limit itself as if it had hit a ceiling. What do I do next? Please help. Nothing. There is no next. So, if ever that question arises in you, what do I do next? You've missed the present moment. So just stay in the present moment. And if you stay in the present moment, then you can't want anything. Wanting needs a future in order to actually to have a place where wanting can find a footing. So, if there's no future, then wanting can't find any place to go to. It stays in the present moment, and so there is no even perception of next. Only now. So what you do next is not really in your vocabulary anymore. There is no next. Dirajan Brahm, happy Tuesday. Do I have to be happy today? Are monks and nuns allowed to watch telly and listen to radio, or do you simply choose not to bother with all that racket? Indeed, it is a racket. But I think I told the monks the other day that we used to have bricklayers here, and when I used to go and check on them to make sure that they were doing the job correctly, they always, Australian bricklayers always had the radio on. And I got to know the time when they would tell the jokes. So on the radio. So I would always make sure I checked the bricklayer at the time they had the jokes on the radio. So I could get more material for my talks. So I got a lot of my jokes from that. That's very good. So, but no, actually, very often when I go to overseas, like on that executive retreat over in Phuket or Hua Hin, they put me in these rooms and there's all these TVs. And they asked me, Ajahn Brahm, did you watch the TV while you were in the room? And I said, yes. I watch the TV, and it's really important, because if you watch the TV, if you go close to it and look very carefully, you can see the reflection of yourself in the screen, as long as you don't turn it on. So yes, I do watch the TV, but not turned on. And then it's much more interesting. You go close, you can actually see yourself in there. So it's a nice reflection of anatta when you don't turn the TV on. Ah! So, somebody, when I was in Thailand, it was quite a well-known monk, and somebody said, oh, it's just really bad news. So what's happened? The monk has got TB. And I said, oh, TB, you can actually, you can cure that these days, you know, with antibiotics. And he said, not TB, TV. I said, you can't cure that. It would be great if you could talk a little bit about the practice of recollection of one's generosity and virtue. Thank you very much. That is part of inspiration. That's what I was talking about this morning. I gave a couple of examples of you get inspired when you recollect great acts of goodness, charity, sacrifice, forgiveness. Those are just beautiful. But what do we recollect? We recollect acts of cruelty and selfishness and meanness because somebody said that to us. We recollect acts of insensitivity when they bang the door. We recollect acts of, again, more insensitivity when they... at 2 o'clock when they need a cup of coffee. That's what we recollect. So we're very silly the way we use our mind. Instead, we should recollect acts of kindness, acts of goodness, acts of generosity, acts of warmth and joy. So if we recollect those, put aside all the negative ones and recollect the beautiful ones, and then you find you inspire yourself, you get this beautiful pity. So wherever you are, in a retreat center, in a monastery, there'll always be people who do things which irritate you. That's the nature of life. But there are also people who do things which inspire you. And that is free happiness, which instead of taking it for granted, we recollect it as many times as we possibly can. Those beautiful acts where somebody goes a little bit extra to help you out. And I remember Ajahn Sumedho telling that when they first went to London, they were put in this little house in Hampstead somewhere. And these were forest monks. They liked the jungles and the mosquitoes. Well, they didn't really like the mosquitoes. They didn't miss that, but they missed the trees and the space and this tiny little house. And they sometimes would go for walks, but sometimes it was a little dangerous going for walks, because one of the monks, he went for a walk and he went past a pub. It was a Saturday afternoon, and there was a big football match between Scotland and England, and all the Scottish supporters were in the pub getting drunk, and they saw this monk walk past, and they said, "Ah, it's Wee Grasshopper, you know, from the Kung Fu movie." And they started chasing him, and he had to run down the road being chased by all his Scottish football fans. And even if he couldn't go for a walk because it was raining and cold, you look through the window and it's really depressing, as I keep on saying, you know, never go to England or London, November, December, January, February. It's a different country. If you go there in June, July, August, September, oh, it's beautiful. Because those days the sky is grey, and the walls are grey, the floor is grey, and no one wears colourful clothing in England. Not when I was there anyway. It's all just grey suits and grey hats and grey boots. And you know what's coming next, the old joke. And even the tea they drank. Oh, grey. Everything was grey, grey, grey. So it was very depressing. And I remember him saying that, you know, after a couple of months, you know, in London, stuck in a little house, cold and miserable, really missing just the jungles of Thailand and the warmth as well. He looked through the window one morning and it was grey and it was raining. Not real rain, drizzle. Just say drizzle and it makes you depressed. And so looking through the window, and he saw in a doorway, huddled against the rain, against the door, trying to get some warmth and protection, was a homeless man. And those homeless men I knew them from the time I lived in London. They would usually drink methylated spirits, the cheapest possible spirit, just to keep them warm. And they stank. And they saw this English gentleman, just like you would see in the movies, with a bowler hat and an umbrella and a beautiful overcoat on a suit, well dressed to go to work. A beautifully groomed man. And as he walked towards this door, he saw the businessman stop to this homeless man and stoop and pick him up and take him to a cafe for a bit of breakfast. And he said all of that smell would go on this businessman's suit. He'd be late for work, but he did this out of beautiful kindness. And he said all the depression left him, seeing a beautiful act of kindness like that. Now those are the things which give us inspiration. Those are the things, even if it didn't happen to me. Someone else told me it, but I remember that. Those are the things which I like to remember. They inspire, uplift. It's recollection of precepts, virtue, goodness. That is why they are reflections which inspire. Dear Ajahn Brahm, this is a very deep question. Was the Buddha fat and fluffy? The Buddha, as I said yesterday, was virtue, peace and compassion. Is virtue fat and fluffy? Goodness is always fat. Goodness is never skinny and thin. Goodness and kindness is always outgoing, like one's stomach is outgoing. So if the Buddha was compassionate, then he must have been, at least his spiritual body was fat. And it was certainly fluffy, because it had no hard edges on it. So I think that yes, absolutely. Not the Buddha's body, but who the Buddha truly was. Becoming a nun, what is the daily schedule? Well, I mean, it's getting up late because I only see usually one or two nuns here in the morning for the chanting. What is your daily schedule? You get up, and then you eat, you meditate, and go to bed. That's it. Pretty accurate. Why do people become nuns? Why do they become nuns? Sound like a good idea at the time? Yeah, very good. What if you have savings and investments? Can you keep hold of them in case you disrobe in the future? How many gold bars? How many shares have you got, Analia? No, we give them up. But this is something which I do say to people, because when you become a monk or a nun, you don't know whether you're going to last or not. Now, the best one in the world, you want to give it a try and see what happens. And so what if you have all your worldly wealth? Do you have to give that away and then you become a monk and it doesn't work out? We kick you out on the street, homeless, penniless. That wouldn't be right, would it? So instead, what we usually do, I tell any person who wants to become a monk, liquidate all your assets. And I don't have a piece of gold in this Swiss bank and shares somewhere else and property somewhere. Just sell the whole lot. And either give it to a relation, or if you want to, you can put it in a bank account under your lay name. So, for example, it is like Ananda Tilakasiri. So you put that money in one bank account under Ananda Tilakasiri, and then you become a monk, and we give you the name of Yo-Yo. Yo-Yo means whoever. You can choose another name if you really want to become a monk, but you know, that's just what came up. Like, that literally means whoever, so Yo-Yo. And so now you become Yo-Yo the monk. That means that money which is in the account belongs to Ananda. It's a different person, so you can't touch it. So it sits there, you can't touch it, you can't give it away to somebody else, it's just there, just in case. And if you do disrobe, if Yo-Yo's had enough of that name and decides to become Ananda Tilakasiri again, you disrobe, then you've got your money there to continue your life. But usually we say after about 5 years or so, if you've been a monk for about 5 years, then it's time to give away the money. If you really feel you're going to do this for life, but you don't give it to the temple in which you live, so you can't get any personal benefit from it. So if that was Yo-Yo's money, and Ananda Tilakasiri, you give it to some nun's monastery or give it to some temple in Sri Lanka. But if you're staying at Bodhinyana Monastery, you don't give it to Bodhinyana Monastery. Someone else. So you don't get any personal benefit from it. So that's how we do things. We find that's a nice way of dealing with the Vinaya rules. So we're not taking all your worldly assets away from you. And as soon as we've got them, we force you to disrobe and kick you out. we've got what we want, or your money. Some cults do that, you know, it's disgusting. So, and then afterwards, you know, you've got your money back later on if you need it. But, you know, give it 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then when you really feel, I don't want to do anything else, then you give the money away. But during that time, you can't use it. Because, you know, we don't need it. We just depend upon the generosity of the people. And if we're good monks, nuns, we don't need. What is your favorite food so I can bring dana for you? My favorite food is pure foods. I love pure foods. And pure foods are foods which are given with a pure heart. The act of giving, if it's done with a pure heart, not to get something back in return, that's called pure food. And that is the healthiest food. The food which is given with a healthy heart. Thank you very much for the gorgeous jhana grove, which is perfectly conducive to meditation. Thank you to all those who are responsible for its management, maintenance, etc. Another big thank you to Bianca, the retreat manager, for her dedication and selfless service to keep everyone well and happy. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. All this, thank you. Are you leaving tomorrow or something? Yeah, that should be the last day, not now. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. It might all change tomorrow and you may have to... Dear Bhante, my question was, can we do metta meditation towards a dead relative? Will it have any effect on the person? Thank you. Of course you can do metta meditation to anybody. A dead relative, especially do metta meditation to them if they come as a ghost. Then you have to, because dead relations sometimes come to you. And you give them lots of loving kindness meditation. Otherwise, they may mess around with you. We monks often do lots of ghost fasting. And there was this one house at Mandurah or Rockingham somewhere around the area. And they weren't Buddhist. They were Christian. And they had a ghost in the house. And the ghost was causing a lot of problems for them. So they called in the Christian priest to do an exorcism. And they tried to exorcise the ghost. All it did was make the ghost worse. So then they came to the Buddhist monks and they said, you should have come to us first. So we went to the house and I wasn't going to exorcise that ghost. That ghost was there probably before the previous owners. So I just pacified the ghost with loving kindness, saying to the ghost, you can stay here as well. The house is big enough for everybody. Just, you know, look after the people in this house. And so there's room for everybody. And after that, the ghost was very pacified. Never got rid of the ghost. You don't need to. And that meant the problem was solved. So you can understand when people try and get rid of a ghost, if someone's tried to kick you out of your house, how would you feel? So instead of trying to kick it out, we just, okay, give it loving kindness. You look after the people in the house and we look after you. And it was a win-win situation for the ghosts and the people. No problem at all. So that's how you treat ghosts. There was this family, I love telling this story, and they realized they had a ghost in the house because they'd been watching the TV and the channel will change. This is an absolutely true story. And so they get out the remote control and they change it to the channel they wanted to watch. And a few seconds later, the TV would change back again. And they realized after a while there was a ghost in their house who liked to watch the TV. And the ghost didn't need a remote control. They could do that by themselves. And so the ghost would always watch what it wanted to watch. And that really made the people who actually lived in the house very fed up until they made the obvious solution to the problem. They bought another TV set. Especially for the ghost. So they have two TVs in there. The ghost watches what it wants to watch and the family watch what they want to watch. That's metta, loving kindness. Look after the ghost. Don't just say, may you be happy and well. Look after it. Imagine a doctor going to your bedside. You know, you've got a fever, your leg's hanging off. And the doctor says, may you be happy and well, and go to another thing. No, it's not just saying these things, it's doing something about it. So that's what they did. They bought the second TV. And so the ghost is happy now. The ghost can watch whatever he wants. Or she wants. I forget what gender it was. So anyway, that's how they deal with it. So meta-meditation towards a dead relation, yeah, of course it works. If they're in your house, you know, buy them a TV. Do I jump on? When I meditate, I abstain. I obtain strange visions, such as in your fifth previous life, you were Adolf Hitler. Do you think it is a possibility that I can have superpowers because I think they are just funny and strange dreams, which are detailed as well? No. There is no chance that fifth, we say, in your fifth previous life, there's got no time. When did Adolf Hitler die? 1945. I was born in 1951. You can't fit five lives in that small time. So that when you do meditate, sometimes you get some very interesting images come up into your mind. But most of those images are created by the mind. They're not real. They don't reflect truth or reality. Just the mind creates stuff. If it does, enjoy it. Because sometimes meditation can be boring. And at a particular time, when they get very deep in meditation, the breath starts to disappear, the mind can play around like that. And if it does, you can enjoy it for a few minutes. It doesn't last that long, and then you get peaceful and still again. If it truly is a past life, then it's like you're back there, and you can ask questions. Where is this? Who am I? What place? Whatever. And you understand the answers, just if I ask the questions now. What's your name? You know, what age are you? Where are you sitting meditation? You know those answers now. If you're experiencing a past life, just the same way you can answer those questions then. So you get details. And that's the way you can find out if it really is a true past life or not. If you get the answers to those questions and they're very, very clear. So, unfortunately, you haven't developed superpowers. So you're not going to join one of those. I see this on the in-flight magazines, the latest movie. They always have superpower people these days. Ant-Man, Spider-Man, Centipede Man, Moth-Man. Have you got any of these ones yet? And why don't they've got Spider-Woman yet? No? Beetle-Man? Beetle-Man, I don't know. They've got Iron Man, Copper Man, Gold Woman. But, I don't know if, oh, maybe you wouldn't know this because not as, I don't know how old you are, dear Yupa, but when I first went to Thailand, it was 42 years ago, there was a cartoon in the newspaper people showed me. Super Monk. And Super Monk was, I didn't understand too much Thai, but you can get just the pictures, what was happening. Super Monk, you know, had the powers typical of a monk. Flying through the air and being able to stop trains just with the power of his mind. And there's, you know, people who were trying to be killed tied to the railroad tracks, and Super Monk would stop that. And when the Super Monk would actually find the person responsible, the villain, the bad guy, I don't know why they're always bad guys. Why not bad women? They should have gender equity in movies. And don't always say the guys are the bad. So they get the bad guy there. But the Super Monk would never beat them up. Super Monk would just give them the five precepts. And that'll be it, finished. The cartoon had ended. And I thought that was amazing, you know, opportunity for a new movie franchise. Batman, all these violent people, they've had done that and been there. Why not have Super Monk? Super Monk who uses his psychic powers to stop all the bad guys. And You know, any time the earth is about to be destroyed, Superman comes in there, and he never arrests anybody. You know, whenever the police come up to arrest the bad guys, just say, "Let go." So they can let go of the bad guys. So I thought that'd be wonderful for a movie part. And of course, you know, number two, after you get Superman, you have Super Nun. And after Super Nun, Super Novice. And then Super Eight Preceptor. But apparently, because there's no sex, no violence, no one's really interested in Super Monk. Anyway, dear Ajahn, Ghost Story was about a lady who went to see a church, but it was closed, and said someone took her to see a very old castle, where she was accompanied by a ghost himself. Oh yeah, that's the old story. I think I've told that so many times. Do you want to hear it? No, don't. If you really want to hear it, you can put that in the box tomorrow as well. Dear, a cult tells people not to think, give up themselves and even the world. So we are told not to think on the first day, and give up the ego, now our will, and even the world of the senses, which is all the world we know anyway. How is this not a cult? If it was a cult, you would not know. So if you know, it can't be a cult. Cults are very sneaky. And you know if it's a cult, if when you leave here, you've got no money left. That's a sign of a cult. It's when you have a cult, it's not even you're not allowed to think, you're not allowed to question in a cult. And this proves it's not a cult. You're allowed to question. And there's no laughter in a cult. That's another sign it's not a cult. What's another sign it's not a cult? You can always disagree. You can walk out any time you like. So, how's it not a cult? But it's not thinking, it's knowing. Not telling you what to believe, but teaching you how to find out for yourself. And it's not saying the leader of the cults of Ajahn Brahm is... No, we have many cult leaders here. We have Ajahn Bamali leads retreats, Asapanya leads retreats, but in a real cult, it's only one person leads the retreat. Only one teacher. And the other thing about a cult is the cult leader is always inaccessible. They're surrounded by their inner circle. And you can't get close to them. That's another reason why this is not a cult. But anyway, instead of a cult, I love occult. Occult is much more interesting. Because when I was part of the Psychic Research Society, you know, psychic stuff, there was always lots of occult stuff. And we used to invite every year a witch. A real one. And I still remember his name. He had such a cool name. Trevor Ravenscroft. That was his name. And he was quite a well-known witch in UK. And Mr. Trevor Ravenscroft, I remember his opening remarks as, "I am a witch. A real one." And he said, there are two types of witches. Black witches and white witches. He said, black witches are really dangerous. I mean, really dangerous. White witches, they're benign. They're kind. And he said, I am a white witch. Phew. And then he continued on, but even black witches say they're white witches. That is a very entertaining man. And I remember another witch reading a book about us. Sybil Leek, her name was. She came from a whole line of witches. They always keep them quiet, but apparently in something like 1950 or something, the British government rescinded all the laws which made witchcraft illegal. So they had all these old laws. So then they could actually come out and say they were witches. And she was also really cool. And she said, the reason why witches are associated with broomsticks, not because they fly them, because in their nature worships, and they'd always go into the forest with their broomsticks to actually to sweep, you know, an area clearing in the middle of the forest to do their little ceremonies. It was just actually to sweep leaves. But because witches and broomsticks always went together, they thought, what do they need broomsticks for? It must be to fly. So that's where the myth came from. She was a very interesting lady, because she said she was invited, this was in the 60s, invited to New York to give some lectures. I mean, imagine just advertising, a witch, a real English witch is coming to give a lecture today. A lot of people would go there, and of course you get the crazy people who said this is evil, just, you know, protesting outside, which gets more publicity, more people going in. And so she went over there, and in those days, no aircraft, she had to go in a ship, like a passenger liner. And they gave her a cabin together with another woman about the same age. And the other woman she was billeted with in the cabin happened to be a very devout Christian. And of course, Sybil never said what, you know, she was a witch, until this devout Christian would get up really early in the morning and do her prayers and hymns and do ceremonies every morning. And Sybil said, you know, in this little autobiography, just keep it quiet, you know, I want to sleep in the morning. I said, no, this is my Christian duty. So Sybil said, okay, if you want to do your services, I'll do my services. She got all her knives and skulls and other witches' paraphernalia, put that out, and she had the cabin to herself for the rest of the cruise. And I remember just in the little book she wrote, which I read a long time ago. No, she went to Chicago, and they said, come on, do something, do some witchcraft for us. I said, okay. So she went to the top of the Sears Tower, some of the tallest tower in Chicago at the time. And it was really calm day. It's supposed to be the windy city, but there was no wind at all. So she said, let there be wind. And all the journalists were there, and the wind came. He said, wow, cool, well done. We've got an article for our newspaper tomorrow. The English witch creates wind on a still day. So I really saw all the articles on that in the book. So, I will say, the occult is much better than the cults. So nice witch and witch's stories, really good fun. Is not having children bad karma? If it was, then I would have bad karma. I didn't have any children. So is that, have I made bad karma? Sometimes people ask, Ajahn Brahm, do you miss children? No way! Because there is a Thai custom that when somebody, you know, has a child, often actually, you know, that the simile of like a godparent, they offer it to me. So, you know, they take this little baby and they literally present it as though presenting a robe or, you know, the lunch to you. They just give it. It's a gift to Ajahn Brahm. So I've got to hold it and just, you know, bless it, sometimes do the first cutting of its hair and then give it back again. And honestly, I can't give it back fast enough. And I say, okay, now it's given to me, so it's my child, but you have to look after it. So I don't mind doing that, holding it for 5 minutes, but not as quick as I can, because, you know, that kid can poop any time. And you don't imagine, the smell goes on your robes. So that's one of the things I have to do. And also, they say, no, do the first cutting of the hair. I don't know why that Thai tradition is. Maybe because they think we're very good hairdressers, but we always have to do that. And sometimes, most kids are okay, but sometimes, get ah! And they're crying, and you've got to be very quick to cut the hair and not cut the ear. So anyway, is not having children bad karma? No, not really. There's a Chinese saying that not having offspring is the greatest act of being unfilial. If that was the case, actually the Buddha did have a son, but if that was the case, Ajahn Chah would have been unfilial. Most of the great Buddhist monks in China would have been unfilial. It's not unfilial at all. It's sensible. Or it's not being able to have children as a result of previous bad karma. Can be, but sometimes it's just what happens. Is there any teaching by the Buddha that alludes to this? No, not really at all. Sometimes if you want to have children, if it happens, fine. But these days you have a choice. If you don't want to, you don't have to. And there's lots of people in this world already. So people ask, you know, adding to the population, and which is one of the main reasons we're having trouble with looking after our environment, there's simply too many people on this planet. And you know, people have been old enough. I remember just when there's much fewer people. I remember the first time I landed in Bangkok at Don Mueang Airport. You got this bus into the city and you pass paddy fields with water buffalo in. And no, there's no paddy fields now. And many people remember those old times. And you know, you have nostalgia for those times. You know, really clean air. You know, water which you can actually jump in and swim in without getting sick. So a lot of times it's too many people around. So not having children, I think, is a very good contribution to the environment. So much so, if you really understand that overpopulation is a very, very difficult thing, the governments of our world, especially things like, you know, Greenpeace, World Wildlife Fund, all those organizations which is really trying to clean up the environment, they should sponsor monks and nuns and monasteries. Because if you come to a monastery, this is before, you know, when you're young. If you come to a monastery when you're young, so you don't have kids, you're doing a wonderful thing for the environment. So I think, you know, we should get a lot of sponsorship from every environmental agency in this world. And in fact, to cut out the greenhouse gas emissions, I think we should sponsor monasteries for monks and nuns. The more you have monks and nuns, the less children. So we clean up the planet. People ask often, what happens if everyone became a monk? Then we'd have no politicians, no generals, no people in the weapons industries. Oh, what a wonderful world it would be if everyone was a monk or a nun. And then people say, well, who will feed you? Robots. Artificial intelligence. The time has arrived where everyone can be a monk or a nun. Anyway, I better stick to the questions. If one is detached, then it shouldn't matter where he practices. Right. What's the point of ordination or retreat center? It's because then you don't have children. And it helps the environment. What's the point of a retreat center? If you're detached, to learn how to be detached, you have to come here. So just like you learn in the school about how to do maths, you don't have to be in a school to do maths, but it helps being in a school where you can be taught by the experts. So the point of ordination is, it is a manifestation of your detachment. You let go. And if you let go, you hang out with other people who let go. So, you let go of your hair. I don't know why people like long hair. It gets in your eyes. You have to wash it. You have to worry about what is the latest fashion. Now you have punk, you have to put gel on it and make it all spiky. Then you come a hippie area, it has to be really long. Then you have, what you have next, I don't know what. But there's so many different fashions and you have to keep up with. This, you don't have, this is timeless. 2,600 years this fashion has been going. And so this is by far the best fashion statement. No hair at all. Bald. As it says in, what is it, Star Trek. You know Star Trek? To boldly go where no woman has gone before. That's really good. Anyway, so that's why we have ordination. to actually to manifest, you know, where our heart is. Why not ordain? If you live like a monk, if you quack like a monk, then be a monk. Do Ajahn Brahm, can you tell a story because you are so good at telling them? Thank you. A story. What story do you want to hear? Story about... Sorry? Rama, that story. Is that the palace story people wanted? There's sometimes the stories, we always like ghost stories, but what about other supernatural beings? Such as, you know, the heavenly beings, devas. And this, if you haven't heard this story before, this is absolutely true. No exaggeration. I know the monk, I haven't seen him for a while now, who is involved in this. And checked it out, and it's part of the folklore of this temple in their books. This was a young American who wanted to become a monk. He was in Thailand doing Peace Corps work instead of going into the army. So he was doing Peace Corps work in Thailand for 2 years, and at the end of his duty there, he thought, I'd like to stay a few extra months and try out being a monk to ordain. But he didn't know where to go to be ordained or what to do. He was staying in a hotel on the outskirts of Bangkok, and he asked the concierge, I want to be a monk, what should I do? And concierges in Bangkok hotels know many things of where to go, but not to be a monk. But at least he knew in this temple called Wat Pho Wat, there was a sometimes some Western monks, some American monks. So he said, why not go to Wat Pho Wat in the center of Bangkok? But what do I do? He said, oh, best thing to do is get up early in the morning, take some food, some dana, and offer it to one of the monks when they come out in the morning on alms round, and tell the monk, I want to be a monk myself, what should I do? So that's the best advice. It's not great advice, but that's what he told him. So this American, he got some food, he got a taxi, got into the center of Bangkok really early, outside of Wat Pho Wat about 4 o'clock in the morning, locked up. All the gates closed. And very few people around, because they don't come out on alms round until just after dawn, about 6 o'clock or about that time. So he was walking up and down with the food, not knowing what to do. And this Thai man came up to him and asked him, where are you going? What are you doing? And when the Thai man heard that this guy wanted to become a monk, he said, you've arrived way too early. The monks won't be coming out for a couple of hours. But, said the Thai man, I have the key. I can let you inside. I can show you around. So they opened the gates, his big iron gates, and walked short distance to the main hall where, you know, they did all the main chanting and ordinations and stuff. And they turned on the lights, opened the door of the hall, and inside these old Thai temples, they have these murals all around the wall. It's a culture. And if you look at those murals, they're very hard to decipher. They're all usually Jataka tales. But like a cartoon goes from left to right. You can follow the sequence. Now, in Thai art, you have to move this way, that way. You have to know the story actually to find which way to go. It's all in there on the frame of the painting, but, you know, it's, you have to know actually which way to go. So this Thai man was just so knowledgeable. It was so interesting as he explained every one of these murals in detail. And also knew who had commissioned it. This was actually painted in memory of this small boy who died of typhoid when he was only 12. This was on the marriage of one of the princes it was commissioned. And it was so interesting, said this guy. And then when it was finished, the tour was finished, it was perfectly timed. The time man said, look, the monks are coming out in a few minutes. Just go out the door, turn right, and wait by the first door there, and wait for the old monk to come out. Now let the junior monks go past and offer some food to the old monk and say, you know, I want to be a monk, can I please ordain? And that's exactly what he did while the time man locked up behind him. And he saw the old monk come out, offered him food, and the old monk said, wait till I come back and I'll take you inside. And that's how he started. But the problem was that you have to learn so many basic rules in chanting. And even though this was a Peace Corps worker who knew some Thai, his Thai was no good really. And so, you know, when this Thai monk sort of started trying to explain it to him, first in Thai he didn't really understand, and then in English, and this Thai monk's English was terrible. So he said, can't I have another person, another mentor to teach me the chanting and to give me some of the instructions? And they said, this is the best English speaker we've got in the whole monastery. I said, oh, what about that temple attendant who I met on the first morning, who opened the doors for me? And at that, the Thai monk said, there is no temple attendant. What happened? And when they heard the story, they took this American candidate monk straight to the abbot, who was, you know, Somdet Nyanasangwara. He became the head monk of Thailand, died a couple of years ago. And as soon as he started telling this story, the abbot stopped him, called in the secretary, write this down. Because this was very, very strange. No temple attendant has those keys. They kept, I think, with the abbot and maybe one of the senior monks. Number two, that is the royal gate. You know that one, the metal gate, which is just opposite the Mahamakut Foundation? I know that one. I've been there many times. No one's allowed to go through that gate except royalty. Everyone else, including me, you go around another gate, another doorway. That's only used when the kings or princes of Thailand visit that monastery, because that's the monastery where the kings ordain and the princes ordain in Wat Bawan. It's a royal monastery. And you can't turn your electricity on there. And not even Somdet Nyanasangwara, the abbot, knew all those stories about who painted those murals. The whole thing was just unbelievable. And then they asked this American monk the obvious question, what did this lay attendant look like? And number one, he was wearing old-fashioned Thai clothes. But, you know, very, very neat. But what did he look like? And I think that's where the American said, well, all Thais look the same. That's what the Thai said. All Westerners look the same. They all got big noses. But then, come on. Now, give us some details. And it's so hard to describe a person you met a few days ago. And so he was just looking around, scratching his head, and that's when he stopped and froze. It's him. He was the person who met me. He was the person who took me inside. There's a portrait of him on the wall of the abbot's office. Rama the Fifth. Was it Rama the Fourth? I always get to miss that. It was Rama the Fourth, yeah. Rama the Fourth. An ex-king of Thailand, who knew all about those paintings because he was there when they were painted. He was the main sponsor of that monastery. And he could go through that gate because he was royalty, he was a king. And that's a true story. That happened maybe 20, 30 years ago. And I met that monk. American monk. I won't say who he is or where he trained, but the last I heard he went to the United States. I don't know if he lasted or not, but I met him when I was in Thailand. And true story. A ex-king of Thailand died 150 years ago. Met this American outside the monastery, opened doors which no one's got the key for except a couple of monks, turned on lights where you can't turn on lights, and explained all this stuff about the temple. Helped somebody who wanted to become a monk. Really nice story, true story. No exaggeration. Checked up many times. It's in the history of Wat Pho Won Temple. Nice story. Devas do exist. What a beautiful place Bodhinyana Monastery is. No, it's not. When I go over there, there's so much work to do. So many telephone call messages I've got to answer when I go over there at 6 o'clock. So many monks to teach. So many buildings, checking up on the wall which is being built over there. Checking up on the UV filter which is being installed to make sure the water is much cleaner for everybody. Talking to all the people with their problems who come and see you over there. People dying, people getting married. I don't know which is the worst problem, but it's my work camp. What do you mean it's beautiful? It's beautiful when you're a visitor. When you're an owner, it's totally different. So, yeah, it is beautiful when I'm not the abbot. Thank you for building it. The carpet in the hall is the softest I have ever felt. And the flowers, incredibly fragrant. I love the little Buddhas in the garden. Amazing. Are we really allowed to have lunch there? Of course you are. Wasn't sure if you were joking the other night. No, you got a choice. You know, if you just want to check out the cuisine of Bodhinyana Monastery. But you've got to know the right day. Some days it's ordinary, some days it's delicious. You could ask one of the monks which is the best day to go. Last night you said a happy mind leads to stillness and more happiness, bliss, joy, jhana, etc. Many people meditate to become joyful, but it seems like from above happiness is a prerequisite to meditation. Is this right? Can the unhappy, depressed mind experience the joy of meditation? If so, how? Very difficult when you got depressed, because one of the reasons why the mind wanders is to escape from suffering. Even like craving and lust, the Buddha was said, was caused as an escape from suffering. You're not happy, so you want something. Have you ever been bored at home and you just go into the fridge for something to eat? You're not hungry, you just want to, you know, get away from just boredom or the suffering of life. Switch on the TV. Oh, first of all, you go in the fridge, there's nothing there to eat. Even though things are falling out from the fridge. So packed tight. You look at the TV. There's nothing on the TV. 65 channels and you can't find anything to watch. Go to the library, pick up a book. Boring. So you can see that's trying to escape from the inherent suffering of life through craving, through wanting something. Why do you want something? Because you think when you get what you want, it'll be better than where you are now. It's not better than where you are now. This is as good as it gets. Really? Yes, so get used to it. And then you find you get happy. So it's important to actually develop that happiness. Otherwise, the only way you can stay on one object is through force, through willpower. If it's through happiness, it's no effort at all. It's enjoyable. So you stay here for hours, enjoying yourself. Happiness causes stillness. The real deep stillness. Yeah, you can force stillness by just holding yourself, but that's just so difficult, so tiring. As I keep coming to your retreats, I find that my patience is improving. I no longer get annoyed with the same stories and the same jokes. No. No, it says here, I no longer get annoyed with people shuffling past, making noise in the meditation hall or outside. Am I on the way to some sort of peace? Also, thank you for the inspirations, me to start on this journey to Wendaripa. Yes. Why aren't there any aspirins in the forest? Because paracetamol. The parrots ate them all. Parrots ate them all. Paracetamol. Oh, come on, I'm trying. Today morning talk was very inspiring. It helped me to realize about my negative thoughts. I know how lucky I am, and to have all these opportunities, I will create more positive thoughts. Thank you. Promises, promises. Will we have promises? Yeah, give it a go. I would like to go to Bodhinyana to meditate. Haven't been there before. Some directions, please, from gate to meditation hall. Many thanks. Just follow everybody else. So easy. You turn right, you turn left, you can't miss it. When I sit down, you know, if you really want to find directions, if you go to where the interviews are, there's a little map there. Very simple map. Dear Ajahn, when I sit down to watch the breath, I'm actually breathing with effort rather than watching it. Good observation. Then after some time, I become bored with deliberate breathing. Could you please kindly let me know your views as to how to overcome deliberate breathing when attempting to watch it? Don't go looking for the breath. Let the breath come to you. That's how I meditate. I used to go looking for the breath, but then it was always unnatural. I'd always be disturbing it. So these days I just go into the present moment, just be here, just relax, watch my peaceometer, get very, very still. And I'm watching my peaceometer, just becoming still, and then the breath appears. You know, it just comes to me. And then it's always very natural and very peaceful. It's not disturbing at all. That's the best way. Let the breath come to you. Don't go looking for the breath. But if you do go looking for the breath and you want to watch the breath, that's fine. But, you know, just watch it from a distance, like I keep on saying. So you're not really controlling it. You're not the backseat driver. You really are the passenger. Because whatever you look at, you normally disturb. The usual exercise is now become aware of the saliva in your mouth. Now, once you're aware of it, it's uncomfortable. And you have to swallow it. That doesn't work, it's still there. So a lot of times when you become aware of it, you tend to control it and interfere with it, which is the problem with even the breath. So just stay with the piezometer, make yourself nice and calm and peaceful, and let the breath come to you. Then it's not disturbing. And for those of you who do have problems with saliva in the meditation, now I've pointed it out to you, now you can learn saliva. What to do is actually you can next time bring one of these little machines which you have in the dentist surgery. A little hook which goes in for an hour when you're meditating. And that will take care of the saliva so you don't have to worry about it. So that's actually how to overcome it. Just let it come to you. Today's evening we had snakes and cheese. Can you tell us if you have any real snake story in Thailand jungle? Oh, heaps of snake stories. What's a nice snake story? You've got Ajahn Gunha's story. You know that one. Our personal snake stories. All the snakes which I ever met there. Oh, there's one story, which is a very nice one. That I was doing the chanting of the rules of discipline, the Patimokkha, which you have to do all the full moon and the new moon night. So as I was chanting, there was a monk just right in front of me, and he was, you know, listening, paying attention. And as I was chanting, just on his on his left side, I saw a little head come up. A snake had actually crawled up his back during the chanting. And I saw the snake, and then he obviously realized that there was something there. So the monk turned round, and the snake turned round. And these two were eyeballing themselves. And the snake didn't know what to do, and the monk didn't know what to do. That's actually on this side. And the snake and the monk, and I was watching both of them. I actually stopped chanting, because there's a good reason. And the monk very gently, very beautifully, just pushed his robe gently down so the snake fell down and crawled away. There's a surreal moment when you saw just this snake and the man eyeballing one another. Because they didn't know what to do. Now, the monks aren't aggressive or a danger to snakes, and the snakes aren't a danger to monks. So all those years I was there, the snake never ever bit a monk. All those years, they were all over the place. They crawl over you, you know, you step on them and just jump pretty quickly. He had a wonderful attitude towards snakes. It was only afterwards that when I left, I don't know what happened, but maybe because of Ajahn Chah passed away too, then we had cases of a snake biting a monk. So I never saw this, but another monk told me the story. They were in the library of the monastery, and then one of the monks, he was actually from Singapore. Now, this was at the International Monastery. And he came into the library and said, "Where's the snake book?" So he got the snake book out, and he was looking for the snake book. And said, "Oh my goodness, that's the one which just bit me." And the monk said, "Well, you've been bitten by a snake? That's a really dangerous snake." So the monk, he ran to the village, you know, it was about a kilometre away, to get the snake doctor. And the snake doctor came in, you know, I think he was in a motorbike, came right in there to treat this poor Singaporean who'd just been bitten by a venomous snake. And not with anti-venom, because that village threw the anti-venom away a long time ago. He started doing his gatha, his chanting. This was a layperson. And he put some stuff in his mouth and spat on the wound and did some more chanting. And at that, apparently, the Singapore monk turned around and said, "Can I have a proper doctor, please?" That's his life, and having this hocus pocus, mumbo jumbo. And he was frightened. But all the monks were there having a look, see what's going on. And in front of their eyes, just, you know, the swelling went down and the two apertures where the snake's fangs had gone in just closed up. It actually worked. And there was this, you know, psychic stuff. Because I never saw that, but I remember them talking about that. They said we had all this anti-venom, and I never believed. You know, these were villagers. Don't look down upon them. They were just highly educated, sensible people, down to earth. And they said, "We never believed this until we saw it ourselves." And this guy had a chant and a way of dealing with snake bite, and it always worked 100% every time. And they said that's why they discarded all their anti-venom for snakes in that village. They didn't need it anymore. There was some strange stuff which you see. And a lot of times, you know, in modern times, they would never even give that a try. But it worked. Strange stuff happens. A chance to overcome snake bite. Do a few more, but I don't think I'll finish them tonight. I would not call myself a contented person, more someone who sees the negative first in any situation. Not a good candidate for jhana. The ones who think they're not good candidates are the ones who get it. Sometimes I do this as a trick. The last couple of days before we finish a retreat, I say, "You're all hopeless." Sometimes I get people who can do jhanas, but not you. "No one in here, I've been looking at you for 4, 5, 6 days. None of you have got what it takes to get jhanas, so you might as well give up." And then people get jhanas. When they give up and they stop trying, then is when it happens. So, who knows? It could happen. "Did Ajahn Brahm, did the Buddha chant?" "Yeah, apparently. Why are certain word syllables of a higher same lower pitches? Is this standard across all traditions?" "No. Why are chants in unisons, i.e. in unison, i.e. no harmony?" "I know, it's the best we can do." You wouldn't believe I actually sang in a choir. I did. I sang in a choir with about a couple of thousand other people. Yeah, in the football stadiums. When they're playing soccer. No, we're trying our best. And anyway, that's one of the reasons why, I mentioned already, why monks Actually, not nuns, please apologize, nuns, but monks, we are the best to get rid of ghosts. Because when we start chanting, it's so terrible that no self-respecting ghost can stand it. And when they hear us chanting, they run away, never could come back again. If it's nice, sweet chanting like the nuns do, of course the ghosts will stay there. They want to hear some more. So if you want to get devils to come in your house, get the nuns. You want to get rid of ghosts, the monks. Anyway. Dear Ajahn, finding it hard to go deep in meditation in any other position than sitting on a cushion, is this just a matter of practice? It's more like habit. You know, it's just people think that you can only get into deep meditation sitting on a cushion. That's what I used to think, but then I'll tell you the story. I had scrub typhus in a hospital for many weeks and just felt really bad. No energy, fever not going anywhere, because they didn't know what it was. They had the idea there was no scrub typhus in that part of Thailand because all the locals had developed immunity. And only when the Westerners, the visitors came in, we got it. But they thought it couldn't be that because nothing there. And so they didn't know what to treat us for. But there was one time I was laying on my hospital bed feeling terrible and decided, why don't you do some meditation? That's what other people are supposed to do. And I did it and got into a really nice meditation. Really deep. It's so wonderful to get away from a very tired, exhausted, feverish body and go into the deep meditations. And when I came out afterwards, I noticed my posture. The legs were all over the place. You know, hands were just one here, one over there, just like you wake up in the morning, but you've just been in a fever. It's all over the place. And from that time on, I realized posture is not important. Not important at all. I wish I could take a photograph of that posture. I've never seen any posture like that recommended in any book. Thank you for the wonderful talk which you have given this morning. If we are our own energy, then how does our will to be kind and compassionate work? Kindly advise. It is because when you disappear, the sense of self vanishes. That's the only thing to do, to be kind. When you don't think of yourself, you always think of us. So that's where compassionate comes from. Enemy? There is no enemy. Who's the enemy? Thank you for the wonderful talk which you have given this morning. If we are our own enemy, I thought you said your own enema. Sorry. Your own enemy. You're not an enemy. If you try and get rid of yourself, then it just makes yourself stronger. That's all the people who try to get enlightened, to try and eliminate themselves. People say, I want this to be my last birth. Then you're guaranteeing you're going to get another birth. So you don't try. The self can't get rid of the self. As it was said very beautifully by Charles Dickens and Oliver Twist, it's like a man trying to eat his own head. So you think about that, you know, so how can we do that? And it's impossible. You cannot eat your own head. But you can say the words, so the words make sense, but when you think about actually doing it, it's impossible. And that's like trying to get rid of yourself. You trying to get rid of you. Impossible. So, you're not your own enemy. You're not your own friend. You do not exist. Dear Ajahn, someone in Bodhinyana walked on 6-foot wall practicing walking meditation. Was it true? When and who was it? Thank you. Yeah, I think that was true. It was just what the whole point was. You have to be mindful if you're walking on the wall, because if you fall off, you'll break your legs. So, have I done that? I think I've done that as well. Just because there was this old story. I've already mentioned the story about the big platforms. Did I? In Laos? Yeah. But they had the same story of Ajahn Mun. He took one of his monks who was always sleepy. So if you carry on being sleepy, I might try this with you. And they took him in the jungle, to this huge cliff. They put him right on the edge and say, sit down and meditate all night. And the monk thought he was going to die. But, you know, he didn't. When he woke up in the morning, he didn't actually wake up. He came out of meditation at dawn. It's just the best meditation he's ever had. And he opened his eyes and he thought, why waste this? And he closed his eyes and just carried on meditating with his arms around. So he didn't eat that day. He didn't need to. So because there's a huge drop, he thought that he would die. So he had to be aware because he had to. And I remember that near that building I mentioned where they had the air conditioner in, which they built in Wat Pho Won, a few of those monks, they went right up to the roof and they sat on the edge. And that's when the abbot, Ñānasaṅgha, said, no, don't do that. But that's our tradition, he said. In the jungle, but not in Bangkok. It will give us a bad reputation when one of you falls off. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what is a Bodhi witness? Kayasakhi, that is a person who's a stream winner who did it through jhanas. One attained the view is a stream winner. One liberated by faith is a stream winner who mostly just, actually, no, not a stream winner, it's on the path of being a stream winner, who's mostly going on just they really believe so much in the Dhamma, they will follow what the Buddha said without question. And one liberated by wisdom is, sorry, attained view is the path. And one liberated by wisdom is the one who has actually gone mostly, not through faith, but through experience, through knowledge. It's types of people who are stream winners, or on the path of being stream winners. But you don't need to know that yet. Just learn how to get some peace, be able to watch the breath first of all, before we get into that stuff. Do we need the breath as a focus to get nimittas? No, you can do it through metta or through casinos, not casinos, casinos, which is a different word but very close together. That is when you imagine a beautiful disc. Or is it enough just to develop contentment in the present moment? Yes. Contentment in the present moment will get you everywhere. All the way to jhanas. And enlightenment. If the arupa jhanas give you the insight there is no mind, why don't we need them to get enlightened? Why don't we need only the fourth jhana? Because you're already seeing a lot of the mind vanishing by that time. So you don't see it totally vanishing, but you see enough experience to infer the rest of the journey. But just get a fourth jhana first, and then ask that question again. How come you don't like monastic retreat? What do you mean? I do like monastic retreat. I don't like monastic retreat. Of course, I like that. Monastic retreat is beautiful. So I don't understand the question. Too deep for me. Dear Ajahn Brahm, this morning saw a kangaroos. And this evening I saw the same two kangaroos. I went up to the baby kangaroo and it let me pat it. I was overjoyed, so I patted it a few more times. One person walking past said that it was bad karma to pat a wild kangaroo, and I should not have patted it, even though the kangaroo let me. Is it bad? Ask the kangaroo if it's bad karma or not. That's why people say, is it bad karma to swat a mosquito when it's stopping you getting jhana? Ask the mosquito, do you want to die? He will say no. So it's bad karma. Do I have bad karma because of patting a baby kangaroo which was wild? No. Do I have to go tomorrow morning and say sorry? No, of course not. They're very cute, the little baby kangaroo. Was that here? Or it must have been in Bodhinyana. Because the kangaroos over here is not as friendly as the ones over in Bodhinyana. So probably was Bodhinyana, I'd imagine. And of course they let you do that because we've been there for, well, it was 33 years now. And so the kangaroos have got to trust us. And, you know, first of all, you know, the mother trusts us, and then just the generations keep sort of, they keep going. And after all those years, many, many generations of kangaroos, the mothers always teach their babies this, in Bodhinyana Monastery, you're totally safe. So the kangaroos aren't afraid of us. So it's beautiful when animals aren't afraid of you. And you go over there and the parrots as well, they come and just, you know, eat out of your hand. And even worse, we had two kookaburras. And they were just such thieves. They weren't keeping any precepts at all. And if you've been over to Burton Yard and Wallace, they used to roost on the railings on the upper story. And they'd be looking out when you take your food from inside on a plate and you go walking out. And if they saw something they liked, they would swoop down and take it. And so often, because you were surprised, and your plate of food would go everywhere. So we thought it was great fun as monks, but then you got some builders, lost their sausage. You know what they used to do with the sausage? Because they think it was a worm, they take it up on a tree, they have it in their mouth, and they whack it against the tree, and whack, because they had to kill it before they could eat it. That's really fun. See the kookaburras kill a sausage by whacking against a tree. But that was their culture. That's just how they've been trained. So anyway, but they were just, so eventually we just caught them. And they're very easy to catch, just grabbed hold of them. And then we took them to, where did we actually take them? I don't know, a long way away anyway. They didn't come back again. And it's a warning, all the other kookaburras, they behaved after that. So it's a warning to the rest of them. But it's really good fun to see those animals there. Totally at ease with you. Not afraid at all. So, and it is nice to pat a little kangaroo. And of course, if they don't like it, they'd run away. How do you go inside when 60 mosquitoes biting you? Because you've got no choice. It's either enjoy the mosquitoes or go inside. So you have to just use that simile of the screen. You can feel the mosquitoes, but they're on the outside. You go right in the center. So, at first you can feel the mosquitoes, but you're not focusing on them. You're focusing on the breath. That's the center. And soon the center gets wider and wider, and all the mosquitoes fall off the screen. Thank you for your deeply inspiring talk this morning. Wow, that must have hit the spot. This, the will is your enemy. Oh, that's what you're talking about. Is this the same way as the ego? The will creates the ego. So, sometimes, we think the will is our friend. I understand what the previous question was about the enemy. So, we always think the will is our friend, and we use the will to get what we want. We use the will to think we're going to get enlightened. We use the will to try and get deep meditation. And if we don't get deep meditation, a lot of times we increase the intensity of our will. Try harder. And we finally get so frustrated. Because the will is the problem. It's not the solution. What is the difference between the will and the ego? The will is what creates the ego. As the Buddha said, it's a house builder. It builds you from life to life. You become what you want to become. Dear Ajahn Brahm, could you please explain again what the difference is between letting be and letting go? You let go of craving, of will, of wanting. And whatever's left, you let be. Last question and then finish off. There's some more here, but they'll be done tomorrow, maybe. If your question's in here and it hasn't been answered yet, it's just because your karma is not good enough. I tried telling my mind to wake me up at 6:30 a.m. in the morning for breakfast, but it disobeyed me and woke me up at 4:20 a.m. It was very wise. 6:30 is far too late, you lazy good-for-nothing. Many people are trying to get in this retreat, and you're wasting this opportunity by sleeping to 6:30 a.m. when other people would give an arm and a leg to come on this retreat, and you're wasting. You can sleep any time when you go back to work. You can sleep in your office desk. But it disobeyed me, woke me up at 4:20 a.m. Good mind. How do you do it so easily? Is it because my mind just doesn't know the time, thank you? Of course it does, but it was too long. So next time, ask your mind to wake you up at 4:20. And then it will do it. A beautiful time of the day. So it's cool. It's quiet. And if you come in here to meditate at 4:20, only the elite meditators come at that time. So you become one of the elite. One of the A-team. You know what A-team means? The A stands for arrogant. No, it doesn't. So anyway, so obviously that if, you know, you've had enough sleep, the mind will wake up before your determination. Because it's had enough sleep, it wakes up naturally. And that's always the best way to wake up. Very good. So I think that's enough. It's almost 9:30. There's lots of questions here. So usually happens around this time of retreat. There's too many questions to answer. So please, tomorrow and the next day, you're only allowed one question per person per day. Otherwise, there's too many questions, too many people. And by one question, I do not mean part A, part B, part C. And you can't ask a friend, can I use your question? So one question per person per day. And if you wrote a question in here and you think, now I've got a much better question, find that question, take it out to replace it. And that's the only way we can get through the questions. Otherwise, we'll be here till 4:20 in the morning, which is the time many of you wake up. So enough. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Okay, have a beautiful night's sleep. Well, you don't have to, sorry. Now, somebody told me how to do this. For a moment. Okay. Thank you.